You're now listening to My Sunday Morning Take, the show where we dive into everything history, everything geography, a little bit of science, and everything else in between to help you make sense of how it works around you from 5 a.m. to 7 a.m. every Sunday. Want to take a trip through history's major events or explore interesting geographical features and even some interesting scientific developments? Well, join us on My Sunday Morning Take every Sunday morning from 5 a.m. to 7 a.m. where we look into everything history, everything geography, a little bit of science, and everything else to help you understand what is happening in the world.
Walk the earth till I fall on my knees. Through heaven and hell on my bare feet. I sell my soul to be with you, baby. If I got your love, I got all that I need. On top of a mountain, I'll build you a kingdom so you can see rivers as far as they go. No matter the distance, I will be near you. I'll be your river, reaching high and low. That's how deep my love goes. How deep my love goes. How deep my love goes. That's how deep my love goes. I would go crazy out of my mind. If I can't see your face, I would rather go blind. 'Cause when I'm with you, something about it saves me. I just can't live without you by my side. On top of a mountain, I'll build you a kingdom so you can see rivers as far as they go. No matter the distance, how deep my love goes. How deep my love goes. How deep my love goes. That's how deep my love goes. That's how deep my love goes. How deep my love goes. How deep my love goes. That's how deep my love goes.
And right there were the sounds of Andre Adriano with the song How Deep My Love Goes. It comes from a, I wouldn't say a pretty old album, but it is almost 10 years-ish. Primarily from the album Life in Color, And this ultimately also introduces us for the Sunday morning session here in your number one talk radio station, primarily here for my Sunday morning take, as you'll hear in my company from 5 a.m. to 7 a.m. Yes, just to let you know, the previous particular time slot did sort of like appropriate like 7 minutes from me. But obviously that was just as one part of that conversation had to end, primarily, just to let you know. So, as we're obviously feeling the particular chills of this morning, if you're finding yourself in the capital, yes, there is a little bit of a chilly wind-ish. And, yes, you know, if you're in any other part of the country, the prevailing weather or climatological, you know, climatic conditions at the time of this morning obviously prevail. Welcoming you to where we obviously look at all the interesting conversations that have happened around the world, in history, so on and so forth. Now, our talk today has a little bit, once again, a look back at one particular pivotal development in human history. And that primarily being from a military history perspective, which has profound impact on us, the African continent, because it was the establishment of a military unit, primarily to bring some sort of national prestige in one or other way. Now, on the 9th of March in 1831, the French Foreign Legion, yes, the French Foreign Legion was established. Now, at the particular time of their establishment, the French Foreign Legion, and the reason why they were known as the French Foreign Legion was primarily because of various prevailing factors. Now, their aim, when they were begun, when they were, you know, instituted, when they were established, was primarily to look after or to maintain or to assist in the control of colonial possessions in Africa. Nowhere else, just in Africa. Now, yes, I'm talking about 1831, and yes, I'm talking about the French Foreign Legion, and this particular development in its own right has a peculiar twist to it. When I say that it has a peculiar twist to it, it's something similar to what you might be seeing today. So currently right now today, we are witnessing a particular chapter in history, specifically where, you know, wanton, meaning reckless, and, reckless warmongering, and the way it is being conducted primarily is a scenario which puts the global community, meaning all countries around the world, puts them on a precarious position or a precarious path. Now, there's obviously a running joke. For those of you that have observed the key characteristic between 3 January and now in February, was it literally 28 February? Yeah, it was literally 28 February. So between 3 January and 28 February, there's one key characteristic. Do not be a major oil producing country. That is literally the running joke. Primarily because you can see that these are 2 main oil producing countries that are being impacted at the start of 2026. Now, besides obviously the sort of like, dark joke, acknowledgement of a severity of a situation and how this particular severity has profound impact of us, all of us around the world. The key concern, obviously, has been, you know, is this part of the new age, primarily of, you know, colonialism? Firstly, from the Munich Security Conference discussion that came through in February, where the world was, for us in the global south, we were like, why is this guy applauding or glorifying a past history of Europe? Why do you have, you know, a major American, you know, government official and politician glorifying the impact that Europe has had on many parts of the global south? Which is still, the big question is still unanswered till today. No one has approached Ruby about that statement. And if they had, probably they didn't ask the question from a global south perspective. But that is the first part of this morning's quiz, you know, sort of like the first part of this morning's conversation that you should always have in the back of your mind asking, or literally just ringing a bit of a bell saying, listen, there is a weird rhetoric being channeled. This rhetoric has profound impact on everyone in the global south. The rhetoric obviously being the impact, firstly, the first obvious impact on oil prices, which obviously influences all fuel prices and all manner of transport that you can think of. And it's not the particular scenario of, you know, whether or not, for example, like with the Russian oil supply, whether or not Russian oil supply has a problem, in terms of, for us in the global south, guys. Now, our particular take this morning highlights, obviously, possession. And possessions obviously leads to the particular economic discussions that we've not fully exhausted, but rather also highlighted in bit part, you know, in small parts here and there, across the various conversations we've had on Eagle FM. And the French Foreign Legion has been one such particular conversation. It's still an institution that still is active today, which still sources soldiers from any part of the world. As long as you are between the ages of 17 and 40, you can apply. Obviously under the pain of learning French, because everything is done in French. The scenario obviously has been the reason it was constituted for, the reason it was put together for. Now, as mentioned, back on 9 March 1831, the French king at the time, Louis-Philippe, founded the French Foreign Legion as a military unit to support the conquest of Algeria. Now, I'll put in a bookmark right here, so that you get to understand the particular impact of this discussion. With the, as mentioned, conquest of Algeria, the French obviously 130 to 140 years later, they obviously had to hand back Algeria, you know, hand back in terms of independence and its independence claims, and they obviously had to withdraw fully from Algeria in terms of their presence in the North African country. As of 24 December last year, the Algerian parliament had unanimously, okay, that's according to the Al Jazeera guys, but it seems like it was an overwhelming vote, primarily because much of their things are done in French or their mother tongue in Algeria, that they unanimously passed a piece of legislation that declares the French colonization of Algeria a crime. Now, I've heard that France has tried to negotiate regarding this particular discussion, but obviously this is a perspective from the Algerian side, which highlights that they did not like this particular piece of history in their borders. Now, if you remember back to last year specifically, when the vice president, that being Vice President Witboy, had the engagement with the Open Society talk here in Windhoek, which Helman and I on the home run also highlighted primarily about women and Africa's particular, you know, the African Union's theme of, seeking reparations for the colonialism that it has suffered, which literally is countered by the speech that Marco Rubio gave in February last month at the Munich Security Conference, which specifically speaks about glorifying the actions that, Europe has committed. Primarily, if you go and study and look up now in the terms of the talking points of colonialism, you get early colonialism and you get late colonialism. Namibia is a country that suffered late colonialism. Late colonialism sometimes also represents certain particular positives. I say positives and put that in inverted commas. For example, infrastructure was, adequate and decent infrastructure was installed. Various other particular economic functions were also installed, not at full capacity, rather, so as to say that a place or a territory is sort of like a crown jewel in terms of manufacturing and industrial developments, but rather so that, just to keep things going for a while there. And you guys, some of you that obviously were born in the 60s, probably in the 50s as well, you might have observed this particular scenario. The question of why couldn't Namibia reach certain, potential heights of industries in certain sectors? And then, when 1990 came, they were immediately just transferred like that. However, when you observe that particular weird scenario, you have one question that keeps popping up. Was this an intentional design so as to keep Namibia just at a certain state? And thus, when the territory becomes independent, they need to sort themselves out. That's a specific question you've got to ask. Primarily when you look at, in terms of the history of, or the history that you were part of, being someone born in the 50s, 60s, or 70s. Now, with that particular perspective, Algeria in its own right, with 100+ years of colonialism that it had experienced, obviously at the hands of the French, Algeria in its own right highlighted a particular piece of legislation for them to advance a formal apology, as well as also seeking reparations from France, in a move that seeks to redress attempts to sweep the issue aside. Now, in Namibia's context, something weird has happened back in last week. I saw the German embassy's, I don't know if it's the charge d'affaires, but I met the guy once at a particular formal event, but he went on a radio station, one of the Windhoek based radio stations here, talking about the special relationship between Namibia and Germany, which it definitely is. It is a special relationship, but it's also a particular talking point that's not complete. And there's obviously, if you've observed for the past 6 years, the developments primarily around the joint declaration and the discussions that have taken place. I mean, Vice President Witbooi was part of a particular delegation just before the inauguration in 2025 last year, meaning end of 2024, after the elections, where, you know, they paid visits to various rural communities across Namibia, which was, you know, sort of like promoting a special vehicle of development. Now, I've not heard that special vehicle yet. I've not seen it yet since 2024 up until today. I've not seen it yet. It hadn't been publicized yet. It hadn't been brought to national discussion levels yet. It hadn't been highlighted. When is the special purpose vehicle going to start doing its particular, play its particular role, sorry. And this has been some of the major talking points that proponents, from the opposite end, meaning those that do not like what, the government currently is, how the government currently is conducting and handling the, Namibia's genocide and colonial chapter. It doesn't sit well. I have to be a fence sitter. I have to be a neutral party. But being a neutral party means also ignoring your particular sort of like heritage and, you know, particular historical linkages to Namibia's own colonial chapters. So, the Algerians, obviously, with that bookmark that I just inserted within the French Foreign Legion conversation for this morning, obviously have a particular painstaking direct linkage to their history and the French Foreign Legion's, start, or the start of this particular French military unit, primarily that it was constituted specifically for Algeria's particular subjugation. Just a last point, primarily on the Algeria legislation development, is that the law that obviously was voted on, they're currently still negotiating, because I read up yesterday that certain particular articles of this piece of legislation were still up for discussion. And this means it was a joint committee of the two houses of the Algerian parliament. They finalized a report on amending the particular draft legislation, which obviously cited two particular articles that were deletion, actually four. The amendment included the deletion of four articles and the modification of seven others that had been points of contention between the Assembly of Algeria and the Council of the Nation. So it's literally like ours, the National Assembly and the National Council. So on that particular note, that's the latest particular development coming through there from the Algerian perspective. Now, we'll quickly take a short musical break. From the musical break, the listeners will step into the chapter specifically of, the sort of like how the French Foreign Legion came to be and its particular impact in that regard. We'll be right back. And that were the Eagles with the song One of These Nights. Obviously, as we are in the early morning sessions, you know, just don't mistake this morning specifically with night. But welcoming you back once again if you're just waking up. Hope you've accessed a little bit of some coffee. I've got mine, not in arm's length, obviously. But, you know, with being this wake, being this awake this early on, you know, you must at least have a little bit of a hot drink to get things going. Not the other hot drinks, obviously, that, you know, the ones that form part of the syntaxes situation. However, welcoming you back to my Sunday morning take. The particular chapter we are going to step into of the French Foreign Legion has, it has a little bit of a very, 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 very easy history. When I say history, I mean its start, its formulation, was based on a particular, you know, economic perspective, which at that stage back in Europe, if you have not known this particular reason, was one of the easiest ways, primarily how, wars started. Now, the Legion absorbed many refugees when it was, you know, constituted, back in 1831. It absorbed many refugees who had crowded into France, as well as unemployed soldiers, such as members of the Swiss regiments who had served the unpopular Bourbon regime prior to the July Revolution of 1830. The July Revolution obviously speaks towards a particular development that happened in France itself. So the July Revolution, meaning the insurrection that brought Louis-Philippe to the throne of France, this is as it's a piece of civil war. The revolution was precipitated by Charles X's publication of the restrictive ordinances in France itself. So it was a little chapter in French history, governance history specifically, that led to a little bit of a revolution, brought back a monarchy situation as well. Now, the demands of imperial conquest, combined with a continuous influx of refugees, assured the Legion a long and over time a glorious existence. Now, it debuted in Algeria, obviously, and not so a glorious fashion, obviously, because they, when they started off, obviously, there were some growing pains. And please do remember, I'm not glorifying the French Foreign Legion, but it's just that their whole existence is tied to Algeria. Factors of mismanagement, with regards to the Legion's particular start in their North African campaign, and specifically in Algeria, were factors obviously that had various particular problematic scenarios for the Legion when it started operating in Algeria. Then they had the aspect of nationally homogenous battalions, meaning there were other French battalions that they had to assist, who were French, you know, Frenchmen, French citizens, and this particular new battalion, the Legion itself, had a whole bunch of people in it. You could have Africans in it, you could have people from the Middle East in it, and there were definitely people from Eastern Europe in it, and other Europeans. So yeah, the whole reason of the French Foreign Legion was that it was a French foreign citizen corps. Then, this particular scenario of the, you know, the presence of the nationally homogenous battalions, who proved to be resistant to military discipline, and who were sometimes also difficult to reinforce. Then they also had endemic desertion. That's now primarily the Legion's, but one of the Legion's particular earliest problems. And an officer corps that was drawn from the least qualified, of the, you know, the officer ranks and file. And then also the most desperate, all contributed to an uneven performance, specifically when the battalion debuted in Algeria. In 1835, that's literally 4 years after its constitution, the Legion was then transferred into Spanish service to help with the Queen Regent, the Spanish Queen Regent, Maria Cristina de Bourbon, to quell a Carlist insurrection in Spain. On the other hand, Louis-Philippe, realizing the continued need for legionnaires in Algeria, resurrected the French Foreign Legion in December of 1835. So he had it, and then it, you know, that poor performance, that poor start in its first performance just started looking, you know, not so good. And then he needed them again, and then constituted them again, and then, you know, started his own particular the, you know, second legion again. Now, this new legion began to take, or began to stake out a reputation for desperate valor during the 1837 storming of Constantine, which is also in Algeria, a particular city in Algeria, under an ambitious officers like, for example, the, one of the officers in command was Armand Jacques Leroy de Saint-Arnaud, who was a future marshal of France. Once the Spanish Legion also disbanded in 1838, that was the original Legion that was sent to Spain. In between when that one was sent to Spain, another one was formed, and as just to let you know, the survivors of that Spanish Legion that had to go and help in Spain, some of them, there's also notable characters that existed within that specific original legion itself, who was, you know, one of them was also to become a future marshal of France, were offered the opportunity to join the new legion by obviously the higher ranking officers back then. Now, life for the legionnaires in Algeria during the particular period of the French conquest of Algeria was not easygoing. Firstly, it was a nasty, brutish, and a short campaigns that they usually had to engage in. Even by the standards, specifically by the hygiene-shy French army, and legionnaires were often used as labor troops rather than as combatants. There was a movie, if you guys remember these movies that, you know, were made here in the 1980s, specifically about, you know, military conquest. Obviously the more famous ones that I remember was the movie by, the movie that starred Willem Dafoe and Tom Berenger, and there was another guy. It was known as Platoon, obviously speaking towards the Vietnam War. Then there was a specific French Foreign Legion movie that I could not, for the life of me, I can only remember the scenes because I was such a small kid back then. But I couldn't remember the scenes. Okay, I could remember the scenes, but I couldn't remember the name or the title of the movie itself. Primarily because it was a movie I've only seen like a handful of times. Now, this one particular sort of like movie highlighted, and it didn't sort of like overemphasize which particular part of Africa this particular section of the French Foreign Legion's history was based in. All you knew was that it was just a desert scene. There was combat. It was a survival scenario of the fort where the unit was stationed, that they've got to survive against local militia groups who are obviously trying to push them out of Algeria in that scenario. And as a kid, you know, you watch TV for the sake of watching TV because you're like, wow, I'd like to be entertained. I'd like to see what, you know, what's this about? In some cases, for example, with that movie, I was not supposed to watch because I was too young, you know, it was literally above PG-13, scenarios. One of the more popular sort of like French Foreign Legion productions, which is movies, which is actually a TV series itself, was the series by the name of Beau Guest. Now, it was a BBC television series based upon the 1924 novel by a gentleman by the name of P.C. Wren. Now, the series obviously highlighted primarily, you know, obviously it's a British take on the French Foreign Legion itself. And it had to do with various particular, things that were going on in this battalion. The actors that obviously starred in it was Benedict Taylor, Anthony Kauf, and Jonathan Morris. But it spoke specifically towards certain particular developments that obviously came through from that production itself. Now, getting back to the French Foreign Legion's particular establishment. In the early formations, the situation began to change also for the Legion with the arrival in 1840 of one Thomas Robert Bugeaud. Now, Bugeaud was to be the new commander for the French Foreign Legion. And he was to become the commander-in-chief in Algeria as well. Now, between 1831, obviously, as I mentioned, and 1960-something, when Algeria got its independence, you can obviously see that the French were literally there for 130 years-ish, 140-ish. And there was actually great, great disappointment, specifically with the Algerian independence, by the French, or certain sections of the French population back in France, who believe that Algeria is literally an extension of France. It's not, they didn't view Algeria as a part, as a country, or as a territory that should be a country by itself. I know that there are certain historical references also, like Namibia was also viewed specifically during its particular colonial chapter back in Germany as sort of like to be a specific extension of Germany as well. That's Namibia. We were at one stage viewed in that same light as well. And if you ever had the opportunity of watching specifically the Algerian, the movie based upon the Algerian independence, where you get to try and understand, you know, to what extent, how severe was this independence war specifically in Algeria's context, you will get an insight in terms of the level of violence that the French used and that the French deployed. Now, when Bugeaud obviously came into command specifically in 1840 as the new commander-in-chief in Algeria, and specifically also as that Bugeaud was a veteran of the Napoleonic Peninsular War. The Napoleonic Peninsular War was a war specifically where the British, they had a treaty with the Portuguese. The treaty was a protective one. So they protected the Portuguese, but from, what's the place's name? Gibraltar. The French obviously were immediate. And the French had been, not the French, the Spanish had been allies during the Napoleonic Wars of France, and specifically of Napoleon Bonaparte himself. So the idea was that in many cases the Spanish army was fighting on behalf of the French army in the Peninsular War, the Napoleonic Peninsular War scenario, and the British were literally fighting alongside the Portuguese and rebel Spanish army units against the formal Spanish crown, in terms of pushing the French out of, out of Spain back into France. It's also a particularly interesting scenario that obviously played off there as well. Now, Bugeaud broke with a strategy of scattering French units into static posts that might be isolated and overwhelmed by Algerian resistors. And even back then, you can already see that that local Algerians were not happy with this colonial strategy that France approached them with. And obviously this meant that Bugeaud had to try and work out new strategies, a new, particular engagement strategies with how they were going to successfully gain control of Algeria. Now, the French then organized the legion, the foreign legion, into mobile columns, meaning that French forces now took the war to Abdelkader, who was a major or like a central tribal, central head of a tribal coalition in Algeria against French colonialism. Now, Bugeaud's strategy was counterinsurgency at its most elemental and most brutal, and the Legion then became a major player in the incessant marching that demanded, according to Belgian memoirist Louis Lamorel, the thighs of a buck, the heart of a lion, and the stomach of an ant. Meaning, back then, you know, there were no cars, guys. In some cases, there were no trains. And when these guys had to march, they had to march in the sun. It was brutal. It was relentless, and it was unyielding in many cases, in many times. And if you fainted because of the sun, you were left there. Now, the campaigns that the French ran against the resistance, the Algerian resistance, was very grueling. And those specifically of the French Foreign Legion who could not keep up, and there were many, were simply abandoned to their fate. You would just be left to the elements. If you fainted, you'd just be left there in the sun or in the desert. And in many scenarios, obviously, the Legion's morale and performance also improved, in no small part because ambitious officers who were in search of action, for example, like Patrice de Macmahon, who was the future president of the Third Republic, began to volunteer for a unit that was always in the thick of the fight. Now, the Legion's officers also began to understand that leadership of foreign mercenaries required finesse. There are so many one-shot documentaries about the French Foreign Legion in modern-day contexts. You'll find former British SAS there. You'll find very few Americans actually joined the French Foreign Legion, surprisingly. But you'll find British there. You'll find Scottish there. You'll find Irish soldiers there. You'll find Greek, Spanish, a lot of Africans always. Do you know why I say a lot of Africans always? For you guys that don't know, is that when you finish your service in the French Foreign Legion, if you're an African, you immediately have French citizenship. So it's one of the quickest ways, primarily, that the French gain soldiers, obviously by migrants, especially African migrants, who they want a pathway into European citizenship, and one of that pathways is joining up with the French Foreign Legion. I know the British also had a specific avenue for Pacific Islanders, and for if you were someone even from, I think, from Canada, I think, and from Australia and from New Zealand, I think, specifically through the British Navy, because if you guys did not know, the British Navy, technically, like the American Navy, they patrol everywhere around the world. And I say everywhere. Now, the Foreign Legion, primarily, obviously, since it is a French unit, there were obviously also in the early days a lot of language barrier situations. There was a guy that I worked with, about 10 years back, who told me that his uncle had joined as a South African or a Namibian, the French Foreign Legion. He said literally it was a brutal place, because everything had to be done in France, in French. You had to do your French language tests, but you were first going to get your French language, teachings. Before you do your other basic training. Well, your basic training would be there, but French language, if you weren't a French speaker already, You'd be getting your French language teachings as well. And the training was brutal, according to this guy that I knew. When you view the particular, you know, constitution of this French, this foreign legion contingent, it obviously meant that it was, what historians will call it, cannon fodder, meaning, these are usually people that you will just give them a rifle and tell you, hey, listen, go and fight for me over there. It's literally also what the Americans did during, now that I think about it, during their Civil War. The Union, the two sides, the Union and the Confederates. The Confederates were the guys of the South. They were the guys that were funded by the tobacco farmers, the sugar plantation farmers, and the other particular agricultural, powerhouses of southern United States. And the Union, obviously, which was the official government forces. The Union guys had a particular problem because they needed soldiers en masse. Now, I don't use a movie as a reference always, primarily, even just to describe a scenario, but the particular movie Gangs of New York had one particular scene where Irish immigrants, because of the Irish famine that took place literally in the 1800s, same period as well, which forced many people from Ireland to other parts of the world, and specifically to the United States. The moment you landed, the Americans used the Union government used a tactic where if you want to be acknowledged as a, you know, as an immigrant that now can work or stay in the United States, here's a gun. Sign up. If you're a man, sign up. Here's a gun. Here's a uniform. Go and fight in the Civil War, the American Civil War, which was an ugly scenario, which you can obviously see was something that the French also did, which was a tactic that was used a lot, specifically in Europe and specifically in these particular colonial powers. We'll quickly take a short musical break, dear listeners. After the musical break, we'll come back and head back into the particular early histories of the French Foreign Legion, and primarily some of the particular, events that they participated in during this scenario. On that note, we'll be back right after this.
Ivy vines that clothe the tree, daisies look and take a peek, sun takes colors from the green and bleaches. December white, a cotton dress, open lawn to make a nest, try to think what I love best in your features. They cut through skin, a new addition to your grin. To reach the end, we must begin to feel it. Lie and trace you on the cross. Heaven makes a question mark. You'll always be in my heart. I mean it. You were born to run. blossoming among the wild flowers, flowers. Pictures start to fade as borrowed yesterday's playing old love song. You had aces and spades, dark side and mind games, down the right to wrong. Burn bridges, building walls, feel weak, you're looming tall. There's no way over, no way over. Free the edges of my soul. Stolen heart, you took it all, tied up in knots, but the chains are long. I walk like giants with world defiance, stronger than I've ever known. Alone, gold as lions, eyes like diamonds. Oh, you hit me with a heart. But you won't take the best of me. No, you won't take the best of me. It ended at the start. I kid myself like a fine art for all to see. A story with no parts, just emotion made of glass, a fantasy, cold fantasy. Across my heart I draw the line, see the picture of the signs. There's no way over, now that is over. Nothing left that's home. Underneath it all, tied up in knots, but the chains are long. I walk like giants with bold defiance, stronger than I've ever known. Alone, shine gold as lions, eyes like diamonds, 'cause you hit me with a heart of stone. Take the best of me.
Now coming back there from the sounds of Andrea Triana with Giants, it brings us up close to 6:15. We're in the second half already of this morning's discussion of the My Sunday Morning Take. And it still is a little bit dark out there. Yes, you are in my company still until 7 a.m. And primarily we take a look at this particular interesting part of history, If you had to ask me, guys, sometimes how do I come upon these particular, some of these subjects? It's interesting things that I read up on. And I, you know, have certain resources that I always go and look up and, you know, researching primarily what's up for the menu for this particular Sunday morning sessions. So developments obviously with regards to the way in which the French Foreign Legion first operated is that they obviously had to find a way of firstly working with the discipline levels that they've got within the unit, as well as also the particular purpose of dealing with Algerian resistance. And by the middle of the century, so that's now by 1850 side, although the recruitment of cutthroats, political refugees, outlaws, and others who required strict and at times also pitiless discipline still exiled the Legion to the frontier of military respectability, the Legion had established its reputation as a fighting unit. Now, attrition had forced Abdelkader's submission in 1847. The Legion then also participated in the siege of the Algerian desert oasis of Zacha in 1849, which also culminated in the long siege of Sevastopol during the Crimean War of 1853 to 1856, where the Legion itself also had a memorable historic assault on a Russian battery at Malakhov on 8 September of 1855. And they also grabbed headlines back in France with the storming of Isheredin in June of 1857 during a very difficult campaign in Algeria. And this is specifically in the Kabylie region. Now, at the Battle of Magenta of 1859 during the Italian Wars of Independence. Now, this was also when Italy was... the various different zones and territories of Italy were now, there was a guy, technically, just to give you a little bit of a backstory, who was going around specifically in Italy promoting a unified Italian nation state instead of these divided little territories. And there were technically two of them, but the main guy was the guy that was literally in charge of constituting this initial nation state to begin with. Then they obviously had a few fights here and there, and the French Foreign Legion also participated in European particular theater of conflict. So they earned accolades specifically in that regard, and where the Legion itself also sort of like started looking more like a formal French Legion that was used specifically for certain international platforms. Now, the French then also intervened in Mexico in 1862 to 1867, with the Legion itself. And although they did not have much success, as France and, in terms of also being present there, the experience also proved the salvation of the Legion as well. Because in some cases, these sort of like additional units, like the French Foreign Legion, the British still have the Gurkhas, which actually source they're technically Indian nationals, but they source Indians just for this particular unit. And you get British citizenship as well if you serve in that unit. Now, the Legion then also participated in some interesting tactical experiments. They also had mounted units at one stage. I know that the British brought mounted units specifically into South Africa at one time. Here in Namibia, obviously the mounted units were also something to be used at the turn of the century, meaning at 1900, because they realized in places like Africa, you needed to be mobile, specifically because Africa has got great distances a country like Namibia is larger, is a country like Namibia, which is an average sized country, on the African continent, or you can consider it an average sized country, would be a large nation in Europe. So countries like Namibia, or, you know, countries that were the colonial territories like Namibia and Algeria is like, I think, 1.5 parts of Namibia can fit into Algeria. I mean, if you look at Algeria, Algeria is a massive piece, is a massive country. So, mounted units in terms of, you know, how they operated. And I'm purely speaking from military strategy perspectives. Mounted units started becoming a thing. It was also the Germans, for example, here in Namibia, they brought the camels, into Namibia. Camels obviously were, and camels still are, till this day, a very reliable, transport animal. I mean, they don't need much water like a horse. They don't burn as much energy as a horse. However, you can walk the whole day with camels and at night you can rest. Whereas horses and donkeys need constant water and resting supply, you know, constant rest and also access to a lot of water because it's an animal that burns a lot of energy. Now, when the French Foreign Legion themselves started experimenting with mounted units and also started staking out specific claims for their own particular notoriety in terms of what, how they wanted to, you know, go on in terms of their existence. By 30 April in 1863, and specifically on the third day, on that particular day of 30 April 1863, the third company of the 2nd Foreign Regiment under a Captain Jean Danjou put up a particular defense against a large contingent of Mexican soldiers at a walled hacienda of La Trinidad near the village of Cameron, known in France as Cameron as well. Now, this is obviously as the French were assisting in the Mexican, in a Mexican theater in some regard. So, just to let you know specifically, this is obviously as Mexico in its own right was trying to, I mean, Mexico in the 1800s was literally like the idea of independence in South America and Central America back then was a tricky thing because, it's like you sending, you know, let's say you're Spain, you send a general to go and a bureaucrat to be in charge of a colonial territory. And then those two guys, the bureaucrat and the general decide to become the new leadership, the new political leadership of a territory like Mexico. Because also is, as an African, when you try to look at the South American examples of independence and the South American examples of, you know, sovereignty, they're not as clean cut in terms of the independences that we here on the African continent endured and the particular goals that obviously we are trying to achieve in our own right. Reason why I say this. For example, if you look at Venezuela, let's start from Venezuela. Venezuela, when it started, was early days. It was a combination of Venezuela and Colombia and Ecuador. Those three countries together, because I know Ecuador and Colombia literally have the same national flag colors. Same too also for Venezuela, but they were going to be literally Bolivarian, you know, that Simon Bolivar guy, that military general, he had a particular vision for that territory that he had cut out of the, that he had literally taken from the Spanish crown, and the Spanish, you know, sort of like colonial administration. And he had a specific goal. Now, the moment, now, remember, Bolivar was a general. He was a military man. He was a general. The moment Bolivar passed away, the three territories split from each other. It was first Colombia. No, it was first Colombia. Then it was Ecuador. And you now sit with Venezuela as, you know, the last sort of like remnant of remembrance of Simon Bolivar's particular overall goal. But when you had to look at how they got their independence, it is not in the same vein as how, for example, Namibia or even Angola or even South Africa or even Zambia and Zimbabwe got their independences. In some cases, it was literally two elephants fighting each other in their regards. You know, it was literally two generals facing off. Or it was a scenario also like the North American independence. You know, the Americans would, through their movies and their, in their, cultural products, they would talk about their, you know, sort of like fight for independence, which actually resonates with us in great part. But what many people forget is that a lot of the Americans back then were technically British soldiers and were British settlers. It's not the Native Americans, you know, what was the one guy's name? Geronimo. But Geronimo came like 100 years later on after the American fight for independence. Let's, for example, say it wasn't like a Geronimo who literally stood up and, you know, achieved independence. And it's not Geronimo and all Native Americans or First World peoples, as they're now known, that are literally now running the American government. No. It's not the same thing that we can see in our context even. So, when you had to look and you're trying to look at, you know, if there are the particular similarities, Asia is the best example, closest to Africa. You can work from China, you can work from India, you can work from, the Southeast Asian perspective. That includes Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, the Philippines even, Indonesia and Malaysia, those guys. Because you see direct correlation in terms of, you know, fighting for independence scenarios. Now, in the Mexican context of the French Foreign Legion's particular involvement in Central America, you know, a lot of things obviously happened and a lot of things obviously went astray there as well for the French Foreign Legion. Now, at the end of the American Civil War, which was from 1861 to 1865, and remember, they were there literally in 1863, the French Foreign Legion was obviously in Mexico in 1863, there were various particular nuances in terms of things also happening. There were also freed U.S. veterans, American veterans from the Civil War, and weapons to aid in the ejection of a French-sponsored emperor, Maximilian, from Mexico, which obviously highlights to you the French involvement in Mexico, in Central America. Now, the insurgent nature of the Mexican fighting tested the discipline of many of the legionnaires. The legion then also sort of like suffered a lot of losses, specifically through desertion, which also meant that they, you know, that when they were operating, and this was specifically as they were operating very close to the Rio Grande, which is that river, the border river between the United States and Mexico. The next chapter, which also played a significant role specifically for the Legion, was its was the Franco-German War between, well, it's now known as Germany, but back then there was still Prussia up to a particular stage. Just to let you know, but a 1831 law that had excluded the Legion from French soil, meaning back in 1831 on 9 March when the French Foreign Legion was constituted, they were not meant to operate on French soil. They could operate in other parts of Europe, but they were never supposed to set foot in France. Even though today they are trained in France, the guys get trained in France, but back then they were not meant to set foot on French soil. This obviously meant that a rule had to be changed. This rule had to be changed, specifically as the Legion, you know, was excluded from setting foot on French soil, and this particular law was suspended by Napoleon III's armies, who surrendered at Sedan and Metz to the German armies. In September to October of 1870, the Legion then, which was amalgamated largely of untrained foreign volunteers, veterans who were ferried from Algeria and Breton conscripts. Breton is like a semi-autonomous territory in France, or Breton, as it calls itself. They were all dumped into the Legion because most French units had been captured or destroyed. And obviously the Legion then had to put in a particular performance against the advancing German armies. Now, the officers were also deemed to be lacking, and the supply system had collapsed in the bitterly cold winter of 1870 to 1871. Now, the Legion's participation in the bloody repression, specifically of the Commune of Paris, in the spring of 1871 also recalled the use by the Bourbon regime of Swiss mercenaries against revolutionaries in 1789 and 1813. Now, the Commune of Paris was one of the first instances of communism popping up. Just to give you a little bit of a heads up, the actual term for communism, they start from some economic historians will tell you it starts from this Commune of Paris discussion. This was obviously as living standards and access to basic services for Parisians was becoming a problem, and the local authority in Paris literally was then taken over by people who were socialists, who had a socialist perspective, to try and improve living standards, to try and improve service delivery, to try and improve overall standard of living for Parisians and Frenchmen, because if you look at France, you will have major cities across France, but that major part, minus Breton, minus the territory of Breton, that major part of France that runs all the way to Marseille, and in the north they've got Calais. There's another part further north, further coastline, further north. It's Calais. It's specifically Calais. To Calais, that whole part of France is technically considered like one major province area. If you get the gist. Instead of, yes, they would have various municipalities. Each of the cities and each of the smaller major towns of France are local authorities in their own right. But the French Republic specifically focuses on that big part or big territory of France. And obviously, territory is now like Reunion, which is now also a extension of the French Republic. And who's the other territory? And New Caledonia, which is on the other side of New Zealand. And Tahiti, I think. Yeah, Tahiti, because Tahiti and New Caledonia look like Europe, literally cut out areas of, you know, Europe, but in different parts of the world. So the repression that obviously took place in 1871 was a very violent repression, specifically. This was as the Legion was used on the local French population. And obviously this meant that it already started having a negative influence on French society in the 1870s already. Now, the vast majority of the 1,000 or so legionaries who fought to regain control of Paris from the Third Republic, for the Third Republic, were French. And this is also as, you know, a new particular sort of like political perspective was to be achieved for France. Now, on that particular note, dear listeners, we'll quickly take another short musical break. After that, we'll come back and we'll head into the last quarter for this morning's session here on my Sunday Morning Take on your number one talk radio station, that being Eagle FM.
I love you.
Show me.
Started, you know that I will love you. Lately, since we parted, I truly know that I need you. I give it all up for 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 you.
Yes,
I give it all up for you.
Yes,
I give it all up.
Yes, I would.
I give it all up for you.
Yes, I would.
Totally brokenhearted, guilty of what I did to you. Lately, since we parted, I truly know that I need you. Yes, I do, because I give it all up.
Come on.
Coming back there from Simply Red on Both Sides, specifically of those two songs. And just where we left off, primarily of, you know, what later on happened after the particular last chapter of the Foreign Legion, primarily as they had to participate in a European European war scene, and obviously also to repress a form of governance of, you know, local French people in Paris. Now, as France started refocusing on a continental defense, the French conscripts who had provided the bulk of the conquerors of Algeria became increasingly scarce abroad. The Legion, along with the professional infantry units known as the Zouaves, which are literally the new types of Marines, and a few French cavalry units such as the Chasseurs, d'Afrique, which is also a specific kind of a cavalry unit left over from the Napoleonic era, then thus began forming a European corps of a largely French indigenous recruited imperial force. Now, the enormous imperial expansion that took place between 1871 and 1914 launched the Legion's golden age. Now, the corps, which numbered about 10,000 legionnaires, participated in campaigns in southeastern Algeria and in the conquest of Morocco under General Louis Hubert Gonsalve Lyautey. The campaigns often were spearheaded by mule-mounted units, which also became a permanent feature of the Legion operations in North Africa until the 1930s. And as part of the France's Army of Africa, which is the force responsible for North Africa, the Legion was also utilized in Indochina and in sub-Saharan Africa, areas normally the exclusive preserve of the French Navy's Marine Corps. Now, the Legion battalion that joined the expedition to Tonkin, which is northern Vietnam, in 1883, became a permanent fixture in Indochina. And eventually it was also elevated to a regimental status as the 5th Regiment of the 5th Foreign Regiment. Now, the Legionnaires also stifled the 1892 Dahomey, which is now Southern Benin Expedition, and they also helped in the conquest and pacification of Madagascar, which took place between 1895 to 1905. If you did not know, Madagascar was also a French territory. It was Madagascar. Madagascar speaks French, even though they've got Malagasy as a national language, but French is sort of like their second language. If you guys remember late last year, when the Madagascar uprisings or civil unrest took place, specifically where the Malagasy general, that colonel, grabbed it. After the president and his cabinet had to flee, and then they fled to an island just north of, actually it was just east of Madagascar, a small French island. It's a small French territory. And then from there they went to another French territory just north of Madagascar. And also last year there was another French territory known as Mayotte who experienced that severe tropical storm. You guys remember that Macron visited it last year or at the start of last year. So there are still like French territories, in and around, Africa, Reunion is one, like I mentioned. There's an island just right next to, two islands close to Madagascar here in the east, here in the Indian Ocean, to the east, in the East African vicinity of the continent. And, obviously they had a particular presence, the French Foreign Legions, primarily in, you know, being present here as well. Now, the Foreign Legion also then generated anonymity specifically in their own regard, because back in France they became some sort of a romantic, they were somehow romanticized, obviously through, you know, storytelling and, you know, cultural works back in France. And the Legion then began to seize the public imagination back, the French public imagination back in France, which then later on was stimulated by the anonymat, which is a requirement to enlist under an assumed name, meaning that you as a French, if you go and join the French Foreign Legion, you have to take on an anonymous name, or you have to, you literally get considered to be anonymous. Now, the anonymity of the legionnaires allowed them to invent fantastic pasts, or to imagine that many of the men with whom they served were romantic or tragic figures in one or other way. For example, one of the stories that supposedly were told is like kings having lost their thrones, bishops who misplaced them, their mitres, or generals who lost their stars. As one particular 20th century legion officer explained, Aristide Meroli, who later put this particularly in context. Now, the possibility of a fresh start in life, a clean slate, in an environment of hardships, manly hardships, as it's written here, and also challenges gripped the thoughts of many. German propaganda, on one end, depicted the Legion as a band of criminals, commanded by sadistic NCOs, into which the naive and innocent were lured, fanned this particular image, as did literary cultural works, obviously, also. Another particular book under the name of Under Two Flags of 1867 by the English novelist Ouida kicked off a series of novels and stories about the Legion that peaked with Percival Christopher Wren's Boguest in 1924. By World War I, this particular chapter brought an abrupt end to imperial ideal. The large number of foreign volunteers who flocked to France to fight for republican principles, as well as also Jewish refugees from Tsarist pogroms who had settled in France, mixed badly with the grizzled veterans of France's colonial wars. Now, this problem was also compounded by initial attempts to organize the newer volunteers into nationally homogenous units. Faced with severe morale problems, including mutinies in some battalions during the Bloody Artois offensive of 1915, and political pressure from foreign governments, Paris permitted many foreigners to escape into French units. The remaining legionnaires on the Western Front were organized into a task force called the Regiment, or the Regiment de Marche de la Légion Étrangère, which also stood for, it had its own abbreviation, RMLE, which, as part of the celebrated Moroccan division, became the most decorated unit in the Legion. Now, although the legionnaires served at Gallipoli, which is now Turkey, and with the Eastern Army, the Armée d'Orient, based in Thessaloniki in Greece, the bulk of the Legion, including its German, Austrian, and Turkish volunteers, remained in North Africa. A Legion battalion also fought the Red Army in northern Russia in 1918 to 1919, before being dissolved, and that many of the legionnaires then joined Russia's anti-communist white forces. That last particular history part of the Legion itself is an interesting talking point, because what not many of us knew, because up until 6-7 years ago, I watched a documentary of the unknown places, the not so known places that the British had literally set an army. You know, the British soldiers had gone to occupy a part of places that you would not know technically that they were British forces. Now, just here after the Maidan uprising in Ukraine, and then, you know, this discussion between Russia and Ukraine, in 2014 became, you know, like major global news and talking points. A documentary came out, I think it was done by the BBC or someone else, about British army history in Russia. And many people were scratching their head because even the presenter was like, when they did this, they had gone through British, you know, British military archives that were obviously opened up or made available to the public. And they were like, so there was British units in Russia during the First World War. So what had happened was when the Russian Revolution happened in the middle of the First World War, the British, the French, I think there was another country, they sent units, you know, to Russia by boat. They sent units to Russia. They positioned themselves in certain particular strategic positions in Russia, and they occupied those particular parts of Russia. And it's like small pieces, truly small pieces. And it wasn't like major cities that were also, you know, occupied, but it's sort of like how you have to think about the peacekeeping forces that the UN sends. So these armies, or these units were sent, and they took up certain particular spaces, sort of like as to observe what's going on in Russia. And then all they did was just stay there. Now, obviously now you're hearing that the French Foreign Legion was sent by the French government in during the First World War. Part of them were sent to Russia, and later on some of them decided to join the anti-communist units, which are obviously, you know, the Russian Imperial Army units, that still survived from the revolution itself. And obviously if you've read that history specifically of Russia, you would know that situation also didn't last very long. It was like a 5-year, 6-year situation. And then, you know, it just died away. And then Russia became, or the Soviet Union as it then became known, started stabilizing. Now, just before the end of our discussion for this morning, the post-World War years brought more imperial campaigns for the Legion in Syria and in Morocco, because by 1933, the French Foreign Legion had numbered close to 30,000 soldiers and had carved out an organizational niche under having its own Inspector General based in Sidi Bel Abbes. Now, the Legion's first Inspector General, Paul Rolette, who had commanded the other unit, the RMLE, in the last year of the war, sought to secure the Legion's place in public imagination and the French army by reviving the pre-1914 traditions, beginning with the uniform. Now, I'll end the particular discussion right there, but just to fill in a separate particular talking point I left open-ended at the start of our discussion for this morning. So, as you primarily heard in terms of some of the sketches of what the French Foreign Legion did, was that this was one of the easiest ways, primarily in terms of how the European countries put an army together. I also highlighted the American, during the American Civil War, that's what the Union side did specifically. New Irish and Italian immigrants from Europe were just immediately drafted into the army. That's now the men. And that was obviously as a surefire way for them to get immediate American citizenship and stuff like that. So there were such particular indications obviously happening in the 1800s, which was obviously a picture specifically based upon how they assessed needs. And if you were asking discussions about processes and the likes, I mean, in many cases, those things didn't work. That just didn't work. Now, when you view, for example, the origins, like the French Foreign Legion, it was based out of a scenario to deal with economic pressures that the European country at the time had been dealing with. Remember, there was a particular military, there was a fallout from a particular military intervention. Then there was various particular migratory moves happening in Europe, specifically as much of the Russian Jews that were pushed out by the Russians in the 1800s were moving into other parts of Europe, and they had to obviously find ways of, you know, trying to assimilate within the various countries. And one of the easiest ways was primarily constituting an army, send them off to a far off place in the other part of the world, and yeah, those guys have to go and find a way to, you know, just as was deemed to be useful. Now, as that brings us up to the end of our discussion for this morning session here on your number one talk radio station, this has been my Sunday morning take here on Eagle FM. And we quickly step into the short ad break. And after that, we say our goodbyes once again here on the Sunday morning session.
What's not to love about USave's special end of February combo? For just 589 Namibian dollars, you can get 10 kilogram bags of each of the following essential foods: Champion Super Maize Meal, Nice Rice Parboiled Rice, Bokomo Fit Cooked Flour, and Marathon Brown or White Sugar. That's just 589 Namibian dollars for four 10 kilogram bags of essential products. Yes, we all save at USave.
Esira shisho, pagyota di kukwathere opovoro kara uasira ya kwenye ochisho. Watuchi itana basic mental health first aid course. Kaiga njua oshari chamhongi kwa mboka iri iyo iyo NHP. Watapewa unongo nonseo nangene una okutongorora omadidiriko ugopetameko igena cha nupiakadhi nenge omathidakano opama viraviro kuchane omokatiko kumekoe nenge anironga pamwe nangoe osho otopewa unongo ukene una okuya kwa thera nukuya pa ea bidhido yiri mwonjira omanga upya kadiboka inauru darara kuyerere o unji na hene unokara uishangitha tarira po epanja yao yo nhp.com.na e mangono maradura thano ododina okurandurwa NHP rooted in care for you.
Your health, your life, your peace of mind. NHP will about you.
Now, coming back, dear listeners, from the quick break right there, and as mentioned just before the break itself, it does bring us up to the end of our discussion here for this morning session of my Sunday morning take here on your number one talk radio station, that being Eagle FM. And on that note, we say our goodbyes. Enjoy the rest of the programming here in our company, specifically as we still take you through the course of the rest of the small Sunday morning session. And to follow on immediately after we say our goodbyes would be the interesting discussion coming through from women in prison. On that note, enjoy the rest of your session, the rest of your morning in our company, and we'll see each other during the course of the week, specifically on the home run.